Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
This podcast is brought to you by bellacatering.com.au. Guys, as we are clamping down in Australia, particularly on even harsher quarantine zones, the international border lockdown has happened, the local state border lockdown has happened, and COVID-19 is just not slowing down fast enough. So catering companies like Bella Catering have flipped into home delivery. If you guys go to bellacatering.com.au, you can find an insane array of beautiful home cooked meals that can be delivered to your door. They are still an essential service. Why go out and brave shopping centers with absolute crazy people who want to sneeze coronavirus right into your face? Why not just stay online and order delicious catering from bellacatering.com.au? Glenn, Maria, the team, they're absolutely fantastic. Get onto their website right now. I definitely highly recommend the look of the butter chicken and the individualized $4 cheesecakes. Do it right now. You have to. And now, onto the show. At about the same time, she said, I noticed a book on Chappaquiddick on his desk, so I asked about that. He was doing investigative work on that case too, on Kennedy. They weren't willing. They never gave me a whole lot of information. Who told her that Hunt was investigating Kennedy? Another secretary in Coulson's office. Then she had seen papers and books on Hunt's desk dealing with Senator Kennedy and the automobile accident at Chappaquiddick. She remembered that one was a paperback, something simple like Kennedy and Chappaquiddick. Some of the material had been checked out from the White House library, she thought. And one of Coulson's aides, she couldn't remember which one, had also told her Hunt was investigating Kennedy. It was verified up the line, she added. Bernstein called the White House and asked for a librarian. He was put through to Jane F. Schlesinger, an assistant librarian, identifying himself as a reporter.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to All the President's Minutes. I'm your host, Blake Howard. Joining me, you know, it's pretty highfalutin times when you're talking to the principal lecturer in contemporary screen media from the University of Brighton, but I feel like we're slightly on an even keel because by some strange osmosis of the universe, both of our undergraduate sort of thesis that brought us into sort of higher levels of academia are almost exactly the damn same thing and maybe share like 95 out of 100 bibliography items, I would imagine. He is also the host of an incredible resource, the Cinematologist podcast, that's building quite an amazing little community in the UK and around the world. But also, you know, he's an absolutely ultra uber fan of All the President's Men. So it's with my distinct pleasure to welcome Daria Linares to the podcast. Daria, welcome so much for coming onto the show. Thank you so much.
No problem at all, Blake. It's an absolute pleasure to be here. I feel like my title that you just read out there is more words than it is actual status. but yeah, it's great to talk to you, you know, on this show about this film, and considering when we had our last little chat, you know, a little bit more discussion of our shared you know, history and interests that come from our educational background and then into film, obviously. I'm really looking forward to it.
So here we are. We're at the 28th minute of Alan J. Pakula's 1976 masterpiece, All the President's Men. And we're here as there's a bit of, what would you like to call it? We could like to call it some misdirection. And the jittery, pulsating personality that is Dustin Hoffman's Bernstein is exceptionally happy. He seems to have caught someone out. So there's nothing more than Hoffman's Bernstein loves than having someone on the back foot, on the back pedal, like trying to say something and have withdrawn it. And we get him now with a very measured presence of Woodward doing that. But as we record, and this doesn't happen often, it hasn't happened often really in One Heat Minute. I didn't like to say the date because as part of when I was recording the show, there would always be, you know, those occasions, and I'm sure that Dario has the same thing on his podcast, where you're talking to someone long time in the, you know, talking to someone right now for a long time in the future. But I just can't help but go, like, in 20 years' time, people are maybe going to ask where you were on in Australia the 12th of March, but in the 11th of March, 2020, around the world. And so today is, in fact, the day. Today is, in fact, that day, 11th of March, or as we're talking, it's the 12th. It's a day that is rippling around the world as the day that America shut its borders to Europe or announced that it would. It's the day that Tom Hanks was diagnosed with the coronavirus, and on the Gold Coast, no less, the seedy, soiled Gold Coast, which is Australia's answer to Miami Beach, just in case you don't know, or the UK, just like think of somewhere skeezy and disgusting. That's the Gold Coast. Lots of guys with sleeve tats, lots of shaved heads, lots of drug dealing bikers. Like, that's where Tom Hanks is right now. America's dad is hanging out with our bikies and really overly tanned, fake boobed messes on the Gold Coast, hiding from, you know, the coronavirus right now, and recovering from, I should say. So it's just a strange thing. We're I feel like in this, sometimes you look at All the President's Men and you're like, this was a moment in history. I wonder if I had known I was going through a moment in history as it was happening, is a question that often comes up for me. So when I watch this minute now and I'm talking to you, I'm like, man, we're going through a moment. Like, I think I'm aware of it. I'm deeply aware.
Yeah. I mean, it's 8 o'clock where you are. So you've had it's funny how things drop, you know, and it's the time machine aspect, or the spatial difference of being in different parts of the world, and how that has a time machine effect. And now we've got the time machine effect of the podcast as well, because obviously this is coming out. But it is literally sort of 9 a.m. here, and I've just woken up and turned on the news. And yeah, it seems to be this could be one of those days where things change. And I think interestingly, I think in liberal democracies, and particularly in the UK, we have this sensibility of, oh, it doesn't affect us. This is something that happens to other people. But just sort of reading the article and how this is, you know, this is going to cut across class. This is going to cut across everything.
Yes.
You know, Tom Hanks has got it, as you said. But it's interesting, you know, we were just talking before we came on about the difference in responses to different countries. And yeah, Trump has shut down now this travel to America from Europe, but not the UK. But, you know, just on the differences in the way that it's responded to in terms of medical response. So in Australia and UK, you know, if you're going to get a test, it's free. Over there, for if you're not insured, it's 1,600 quid to get a test. So people are going to be making money on this in America. We're in a kind of very, very strange times.
It's the deeply strangest day. And so, you know, I think maybe it's like a pod, it's definitely this podcast first, but like, I don't know about you, Dario, occasionally, and I've never mentioned on a podcast, but I feel like you're a fellow podcaster. So this is the right time. I've been doing that stupid carnivore diet. I'm just going to call it what it is, because I heard about it on another great podcast, The Joe Rogan Experience. I thought, I'm going to give it a try. And so I thought, well, at the beginning of March, I'll do that. My friends have all, you know, a lot of my friends have gone plant-based. I've gone the complete opposite. Environmental consciousness from my decision, purely a cognitive function and energy decision with a full life. And one of my decisions was, I'll give up booze as well. Why not? Why not? Why not give up booze? And today, between 9 a.m. and about 12, that decision was like, yeah, the booze is coming back. Yeah. I can still stick to the meat. I won't eat any carbs or vegetables.
Well, you can call it medicinal now, can't you? Especially gin, you know what I mean? Just swamp yourself in that and it'll give you a bit of protection, hopefully.
It's just one of those, yeah, it's a really strange time. So it's you know, so for folks listening as the day that this has dropped, I hope that you're taking care and you know, we don't know the full effects of it. And unfortunately, it is like attacking people who are deeply vulnerable, you know, elderly people, people with respiratory issues, people potentially who are obese, people potentially who've got blood pressure issues. You know, if you've got underlying medical issues that make you more vulnerable to things like people who contract, when they contract pneumonia, that basically says that if you're going to get the coronavirus, which a whole swathe of the population is definitely going to get, like our medical examiner in New South Wales, she believed today, she announced that she thinks that 1.5 million of the 6 million people that are in the greater Sydney area are going to get it. And therefore, if you're looking at like a 3.4% or whatever it is, death rate, then that is significant. So it's just one of those things. The world is going to change. It's going to be those times. It's going to be a very strange year. And I know there are a lot of people that were like clawing with every part of themselves to get out of 2019 alive and thought 2020 is the year. And it has just been just this cavalcade of strangeness. And in Australia, particularly, we had the bushfires that were completely cut off from our summer. You know, a lot of people are affected. Now there's a lot of people who are isolated without, you know, still without home, some without power, some with, you know, that have had to lose their jobs and all this sort of stuff. And then the coronavirus comes in and these like people that are drastically affected, we're going to spend the rest of the year supporting, are all kind of now hung out to dry. It's this really, it's an insane time, and it's going to be an insane time around the world. So I just felt like we would be neglecting the ethos of these journalists if we didn't mention that right at the top of the show, in case that reflects.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, I was just going to say, I think that the climate crisis needs coronavirus's PR.
Yes, it does.
Because, you know, I think that the way that this has sort of been reacted to and the way that scientists are being listened to, you know, and I mean, yeah, you could count Trump apart from everything as always, but yeah, just we had the budget yesterday, and there was a sort of blank check written in terms of whatever the NHS needs, and it's just it seems that politics has kind of gone out the window a little bit in terms of we are going to respond to this, and it's just amazing the difference in terms of the arguments we have over the climate crisis.
Yeah, I just think it's about what's more immediate, right? And it's so strange that it takes something like that to do it. And in Australia, the client, you know, after years of conservative governments in Australia just completely ignoring climate change and climate crisis, and there was a whole swathe of, you know, protests and whatnot that went ahead around the time of the bushfires, and then obviously all the bushfires happened, and there was all the scientists that were sort of out there saying, you know, you've literally ignored climate science, you've literally ignored the conservation efforts of, you know, your rural fire services and their recommendations to backburn, even though it was a higher risk to backburn, to reduce the overall risk when the temperatures got too much and all that sort of stuff. So I don't think it's impossible. I just think it's like, you know, it's that kind of collective myopia. Maybe it's even relates to this project for me. Like I have this myopic view of something that I have to unpack and understand and often come back to after many years of it being released to reflect on. And I just think that a lot of people don't have the energy for multiple crises to deal with them at once. They're hoping that there are great people that are involved, and they're hoping that people like their governments have the capacity to plan and put things in place. But I just genuinely don't think they do. Like that, you know, and also if we're not talking about it, people don't care. So when people are starting to literally die, and especially people who are older and smoke and have respiratory issues, which is a lot of men and a lot of men in political power potentially susceptible to the worst of this thing. I think it's like, it's a massive wake up call for everyone, because it's like there are deathly consequences to it, and stopping it spread and inoculating and all that is so important.
The immediacy is definitely the thing. Yeah, and just and reiterate. I mean, it's interesting how when this goes out, it's probably, what is it going to be? 6 weeks ago is going to be.
It's probably going to be a few weeks. Yeah, like yeah. I'm actually going to increase the run of the episode. So this might be like in about 10 days after it's recorded, or maybe like by the end of March. So we're recording that. So yeah, it's going to be about 3 weeks later.
So I wonder what's going on this week. I wonder what's gone on in that time period. We could be.
Hey, we're speaking. You know, we're now addressing you.
Happening on this day.
We're now addressing you in the future, and we hope that Jesus, or we hope that something is being handled. So, what we're going to do is we're going to stop this 11-minute tete-a-tete between my extremely talented and knowledgeable guest, and stop talking about things like coronavirus, and bring it back to what is one of his favorite and formative films, and self-evident, me, the host of All the President's Minutes, one of my deeply favorite films, to talk about just a great turning point moment in this wonderful paranoia thriller. Because, you know, there are the tinfoil hatters out there, even in the coronavirus right now. So let's have a look at, you know, why people maybe scratch that itch for a bit of tinfoil hat work. So let's have a look at it now. You guys are going to listen along, and then Dario and I are going to come back and unpack it.
What? And then she comes back and says, I don't even know Woodward.
Mr. Woodward, Ken Clausen calling back. I've just talked with the librarian.
Yes, sir?
She denies that the conversation with Mr. Bernstein ever took place, and she
I'm said sorry.
She referred
Excuse
him
me,
to
sir, I'm sorry. You say she denies even knowing about the conversation taking place?
That's right. She said someone did call her asking about Mr. Hunt, but all she did was refer him to the press office, and she denies that any other
Total
conversation
bullshit.
Took place. I hope that's been of some help to you.
Thank you. Got to get something on paper.
Why, very kind.
Mona? Excuse me. Mona, could you take any calls at the moment?
Sure.
Where's my note? If I get any calls.
Can you get that check?
I don't know.
There it is, the 28th minute. It is a great little minute. For a lot of reasons, my favorite element. Before I let you dive in, my favorite element is later on in the film. There's a couple of scenes where these guys are frantically, manically taking notes, and people are downloading information that is huge scoops in the story. And later on in the film, as part of the technique of each guy learning each other's lines so they could say them, Woodward is like great chorus to Bernstein's. Like, he's got the notes verbatim, like, and he sort of trusts him. But I love this as a pivotal moment because Woodward is scrutinizing his stuff and his paranoia just like any editor would. Like, it's his moment to actually have a little bit of, you know, editorial, sort of an editorial mindset and go, like, yes, that conversation changed, but it's not really proof. We need to actually get some clarity here, ask more questions, don't just take face value, etc. And so it's just one of those great things where it's like, okay, this is actually happening, it's here. But I would love to hear you unpack it.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, when you assign, I wasn't precious about which minute it was, but when you assigned me this, I said, oh, that's absolutely wonderful. Because I think this is the moment when this becomes, this changes from a story about journalism to a conspiracy, a paranoia film. And it's what's really important is the previous scene. As well, so
yes.
I don't know who you've got doing the previous minute, so it'd be interesting.
Well, people
to,
can
oh,
listen
I'm
now.
Really
it was
to hearing
it,
that.
It is actually the incredible Drew McWeeny, so the
great
who was Moriarty on Ain't It Cool. That's how far Drew goes back. But Drew is now sort of an independent freelance film journalist, and has the formerly Dangerous newsletter that comes out, which is basically just this wonderful column that is kind of part review, part stream of consciousness, part, you know, 25 years in the biz insider experience. It's just sensational. So I knew in this corridor, it's funny, in this corridor I was like, I'm just happy with anyone getting these few minutes, because I just know that they're going to have a field day, because it is such a great turning point moment in the movie.
Yeah, I mean, in the previous scene then, I'm looking forward to hearing what he's got to say about that, because that the phone call with the librarian
yes.
is just key. And I think what happens when Bernstein, obviously he's on the phone and he's taking the notes, and then this something has happened on this phone call and you hear it, and he takes the notes over to Woodward, and at the beginning, he gives him the notes and just, I think he wants to let him read them, you know what I mean? Just to see if he can get the same impression just from the notes. But then he gets impatient and is like, yeah, no, there's a contradiction that's happened here. But and I think what's interesting is just on a kind of filmic dramatic level, I don't know whether this took place in this way, but the Bernstein could have called Ken Clawson himself.
Yes.
And say, I've just spoken to the librarian. But what this allows is going over to Bernstein and showing him the notes and getting that confirmation, as you say. But then Woodward phones Clawson.
Yes.
And that gives the dramatic interplay. It allows that to take place. So a conversation can happen, which gets them to this point, which I think is almost the key to the entire movie. Not saying that this minute is, but the sentiment behind it is that Woodward asks Bernstein, you know, we need something on paper that says that books were taken out. We need evidence. We need something to underpin what we're going to say. And Bernstein's like, yeah, that's fine, but that's not important. What's important is the machinery of conspiracy that's behind that. You know, yes, what I mean? He just begins to realize it here.
And it's his inclination, which is good. The awakening is, you're so right about this minute and this surrounding scene, because the awakening is Woodward. Like, Bernstein seems to, like, he's that far left radical. He's sniffing out, you know, he's lived through the Pentagon Papers. He's been in the paper for a long time. Like, Woodward's been there for 9 months. The Pentagon Papers are right around, you know, they've all happened, and he's sniffing out knowing that there's something here. And what's so amazing is, and just another, like, outstanding phone performance, like, speaking as audiophiles as we are, how good is the librarian's phone call? Like, so,
that's great.
Well, he did take a lot of books out about, you know, Senator Kennedy. I've got it here right now. So, Mr. Woodward, I was wrong. And it's that inflection, that intonation, that drop, you're like, oh my God, this is so perfect. It's exactly what you need. And that interplay is so great because, like you said, there is a sniff. There's something here. And I go one step further to your sort of pondering is, I want to know if the way that they built the dramatic crux of this scene was, let Woodward read it and you decide Hoffman as Bernstein when you're going to interrupt him, when he doesn't get it. When he doesn't get it. And that's what's, I just, these guys hear this chemistry and then the call, so pure. I'm going to call Ken Clawson. So even in the minute that follows you, so we can play that. We love to play the game where we cheat your minutes. But it's like,
I know the number. I know the number.
Yeah. I know the
when
number.
When he says, there's that little bit of competition between them all. It's like, I know the number.
But I just love, and he calls Clawson and he's like, oh, I just want to find out. And on Woodward's face at the end of that exchange, it's kind of like, Clawson's going to clear this up. It's not what you think it is.
And when
he comes back and he says,
then
yeah, sorry, go ahead.
Sorry, go ahead. Overlay. But it's interesting whether, because obviously we can't see what's going on, and that's the whole beauty, and I'll come to that, the use of phone calls in a minute. But it's unclear whether Clawson was in on the first call or not. We don't know that. And whether Clawson's position in this is actually honest, you know what I mean? Like, he calls the librarian and the librarian lies to Clawson, or whether Clawson is in on the first conversation, or, you know, has realized what's going on and says, no, lie to Bernstein, and then has to lie to Woodward as well. Do you know what I mean? So all of that is unclear, but we have to kind of figure.
I've never thought of who the intercept was.
Was Clawson.
Oh. And it absolutely could be Clawson, in which case it makes it even more of a tantalizing proposition, because he's flat out lies, thinks that they're just going to get away with it. And then when someone's got the temerity to come back and say, we just heard this from a White House librarian, have you got anything to say about it? Look, let me look into it. And then what's the story? No, she denies the conversation ever took place. Shut the door. That is so interesting, Dario. That's one of my... And people probably who listen to podcasts that I do are going to get sick of me saying it. That's something I never thought of. And I'm like, now I'm like, it is Clawson. That conversation can now, you know, if it is him, it reeks with a whole different little bit of subterfuge. It's like this guy is trying to, these people, the machine, like you said, Bernstein's so emphatic. Like, if someone can be gotten to in the 10 to 15 second hold that I have when they go to check something for one of these guys in the White House, then the machine is protecting them. Like, what else is, like, then the question becomes, what else are they hiding? Like, if they're just hiding what was borrowed from the library, what the hell else could they possibly be hiding?
Yeah, I mean, and that's the basic structure of the movie is all behind these phone calls. So in a sense, everybody, there is, in your mind as a film watcher, as an audience member, all you're doing is thinking, oh, there's some person behind who's knitting all of this together, but it doesn't work like that. You know, these are networks upon networks, and it's because everything's behind a phone line and the machinery is behind that, it all becomes kind of like one entity in your brain.
Yes.
You know, but actually there is so many machinations that must have been going on, like who's telling who to do what and who's linked to who, and it's kind of like, yeah, it's that's what makes a conspiracy, I think, because you're looking into the teeth of it, and it seems so overwhelming. But yet, it's just this one idea of a conspiracy being controlled from somewhere.
It's that great thing of like the system incentivizes the corruption, right? It's that sort of apartheid thing of like the system incentivizes the corruption, and you have to treat the system as that exactly that. You have to treat it as an entity that people are incentivized to, you know, to participate in, and that's why they do like awful shit, or they lie, or they, you know, they kind of use espionage style tradecraft to keep the truth from journalists who've got every right to do it. And I was just going to say, you know, I wonder if Trump's borrowings from the Library of Congress are available, but that would be too, maybe that's too aspirational for the sitting American president to read.
Well, you probably couldn't stitch them all together in a coherent line anyway. You know what I mean? It's like, what the hell is he actually saying? I mean, that's his genius. Maybe we'll come to that towards the end. You know, but,
No. I don't know. Yeah. I've described Trump thusly. Look, we all have an uncle who drinks, okay? We all have one. And we all have gone to family functions where said uncle has espoused many a confidently delivered theory, which is just bullshit. And you enjoy it because there's a communal experience of like, this is fun. I mean, we're all having a good time, and Uncle so-and-so, he can tell us all the theories. And when we leave, he's still the mad one. And we're going to go home and live our lives. And I genuinely feel like that about Donald Trump, in that he's so stupid and confident, but like he's that guy. But then you realize your uncle runs like a massive company, and then you'd be worried. Like if you found out that uncle was if you know that uncle is like just works in construction and he's just a local bricklayer and that's what he's done his whole life, I'm like, more power to him. He can have crazy theories and lay really good brick. But if you found out he was a brain surgeon, you'd be like, oh dear God, get the scalpel away from him. So I think that's that weird thing of like when power that can affect you is indirectly associated with someone who is that crazy and just such a blowhard. It's like, oh, he's fine. He's harmless. Cause I think there's this weird, like drunk uncle familiarity, but him, he's a special kind of like, I love science. I get it. Like, what are you talking about?
I mean, it's interesting. One of the few ways maybe that the film is dated, and I don't mean dated in that you can't watch it because it's, you know, it just looks so old-fashioned, but I think it's that sense that these guys and the Washington Post as an institution set off from the premise that they don't believe that the president is corrupt.
Yes.
You know what I mean? It is this kind of idea. It's, oh, there must be some kind of infiltration or group of people who are doing things nefariously. And the top guys, you know, they're our leaders. They don't know about all of this. Whereas now, you know, the idea that the top guy is not in on it, you would just be completely naive not to think that everybody knows. And it's an interesting move away from trust of organizations that's taken place, I think, you know, post 70s to now, sort of more over time gradually.
And in 70s, it was radical. It was contending with the morality of that, and I think that that's the, you know this as a scholar, is, you know, there's when you are familiar with the films, like when you're familiar with contemporary films, sometimes you lose sight of the films that inspired them. You know, like I'm a big fan of Heat, and someone today, I think it's at Pinland Empire, did this beautiful thread, and if you go back through my Twitter, you can find it or his, of like a whole bunch of scenes, like shots even, that were so beautifully composed in Rafifi, which I think is a 1930s gangster.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And compared them to scenes in Heat and frames in Heat, going, these are scenes that Michael Mann has clearly been influenced by. And I think that that's, in this moment and this time, which is, I think, why both you and I have such an affinity for the cinema of this time, it's wrestling with the morality of this moment where you literally watch a culture awaken to the possibility that everything that they've been told is bullshit. And like that American dream, that aspiration, they've got to wrestle with that crumbling of the American dream. And sort of there's reactionary weirdness that happens after that. And that's reflected from the political stuff, which goes to, you know, there's a great theorist called Susan Jeffords who calls it the remasculinization of America. And it's like the difference between First Blood and First Blood Part Two is like First Blood is about a guy who's messed up, who has PTSD, who it's this absolutely powerful movie of people of hometown prejudice, small-minded prejudice, butting up against a person who's been basically programmed to be a warrior. Coming home, they tweak that thought in him, and then he goes wild, and people have to wrangle him, and just shows the incongruity between war mindset and life and how weird that must be. And, you know, in the book, he kills himself. And then the second one is like a Vietnam revenge gore porn. Like, that's basically what it is. And so I think that that's why I love this corridor, is because they're still wrestling with it. They're still finding out. They're still coming to terms with it. And so later on, I think if you, it's a great thing to sort of understand how that evolved, because now we just take for granted that politicians are corrupt. I think we go to the, like you said, we go to the game. If there's a politician standing on a stage talking to you, at some point you're like, they're corrupt. How are they there?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like you get a Bernie Sanders and you're like, that guy's an outlier. Like the guy's been working in the biz, you know, working as a politician, as a public servant for that many years, and he's not corrupt. It's like, wow, that's really incredible. You know, that's that, you know, both of us looking over. But like when I even look at Australian politicians, I'm like, yeah, they're corrupt. They're doing weird stuff. You know, it's not just an American thing. But yeah, I wonder when it like completely, I don't know what the example is that it completely turned, but it's like, it must be like Lumet's network, where like by the time we hit network, it's accepted that corporate interference in politics and big business and all that sort of stuff, it's just there, like it by that time.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting in the UK where that is. I mean, I grew up in the era of Thatcher.
And, yes.
And I don't think mirrors stuff happens behind closed doors and always has, you know, right back way before the 70s. But I don't think there was ever a sense of attached to Thatcher, because she just did what she was going to do anyway. You know, she was that kind of politician. Maybe it was more when, especially for my generation, sort of what happened with Tony Blair, you know, because Tony Blair had this amazing sort of entry into becoming prime minister in 97, where literally that was the first sort of political moment where I was watching TV with a sort of sense of hope, you know what I mean? It's like Obama was the other one, I think. But, you know, subsequently, obviously, what's happened with Tony Blair, that sense of cynicism, and watching things like TV shows like The Thick of It.
Yes.
And then the film In the Loop, which, you know, I love those movies. And it's just that kind of sense of behind the scenes venality and absolute disregard for any kind of moral compass whatsoever. And that's just within the people that they hang around with. So they have no interest in the electorate at all. So, yeah, maybe. And now, you know, Trump has, to coin a cliche, has taken it to a whole new level, obviously.
Oh, yeah. It's very special. It's a special time. Everything is getting stranger. I think it's when, it's the weird and strange thing. And I just looked up, Network is actually 1976. So you've got to think that the actual events that are being portrayed in what we're watching, sort of 1972, Nixon's out in 74. They're in the middle of producing this movie. It releases January 1st, 76. So I think it's like within that 4-year period, Lumet and that maybe the American psyche has just kind of gone, no, everything's corrupt. Like there are people behind this that are doing these things. And obviously Network is the most sort of overt, surreal, in some ways, and sort of abstract, you know, big white boss man, you know, manifestation of evil of the corporate world. But it's like that. And, you know, I don't think there's any doubt that Trump's corrupt. What I think is funny, though, and it plays into your point, and this conversation taking you back to this minute, is when you watch people like not wanting to impeach the president because they know that he did something wrong, but they just don't want to impeach him. They're like, yeah, look, I know he did something really wrong, but nah, I don't want to impeach him. It's like, that's when you go, wow, this system is broken, because they're all like sucking the teat of that system and self-perpetuating cycle of like the sameness is going to help them continue to coexist. And that's that system. Like, they're incentivized to do the bad shit. So of course they're going to keep doing it because they're incentivized to do it.
Yeah. And what's interesting as well is whether the notion of a film that trades on the mood or the aura of paranoia
still can
work in 2020, because, you know, there's that sense of, in all of Pakula's films, and then if you think of the earlier cycle, Frankenheimer's films like The Manchurian Candidate or Seconds, and then even later stuff like, you know, 3 Days of the Condor, which is Redford again and Sidney Pollack film, and sort of stuff like Videodrome or Brian De Palma's Blowout.
And even these are also, like, John Carpenter's Them is another great one.
No, absolutely. But it's like that idea of the sense of the mood of paranoia that somebody is watching you, somebody is listening in, and there are machinations around that, which is about withholding information from you or keeping information about you secret. Whereas now we just volunteer everything.
Yes.
We volunteer it all. We just give it away. And like, I mean, you know, we're all on social media in some way, shape or form. Most of us are. And I've got the Google Home in my house, so they're listening to us right now.
Yeah, I've got Alexa, and because now my daughter Hazel is 3, and she doesn't really know how to say Alexa. She says Jalexa, but Alexa does, and I don't realize that I forget Alexa's there unless I'm actually saying the thing, like, "Hey Alexa, you know, what time is it? Hey Alexa, play the morning news, you know, whatever." And she's like, "Jalexa," and then like it just pops up, and I'm like, "God damn it. I got to turn this bastard off. They're just hearing everything that's going on in my house and in my kitchen, in my private time."
No, absolutely. Yeah, it's like that end sequence in The Conversation, Francis Ford Coppola's film with Harry Cole, where he's literally
one of the greatest, maybe in the top 10 movies of all time.
Yeah, absolutely. And he's tearing his own apartment completely apart because he's searching for the bugs. And he's a guy. I mean, it's a great movie about sound in cinema, and because it's about a bugger in the kind of recorder sense of that word, you know. So he is somebody who engages in surveillance, audio surveillance of conversations, and he works in this kind of metal cage which keeps all of the bugs
of
the interference out. Yeah, but then obviously in a lot of these conspiracy films, there is somebody who is the listener who becomes listened to, and his paranoia. I mean, that is the ultimate scene of film paranoia, I think. Him just completely tearing, and he cannot find anything. And it doesn't work anymore.
There was Antonioni's Blow Up, and there was, of course, Brian De Palma's Blowout, which a lot of people point to. But the superior film in every conceivable way, in my mind, is The Conversation. And very recently, I was really lucky. A couple of already guests on the show, frequent guests on One Heat Minute Productions, Garth Franklin, the editor of Dark Horizons, and Stu Coote from The Cinephiles. The three of us went to a little tiny repertory theater in Sydney. It's called Our Golden Age. It's a little golden age, tiny little old theater. And they were playing The Conversation. And so we went along and saw it. And it's only in the last couple of months. And I think it was just like this perfect complement to me doing this film and embarking on this project. And I noticed something for the first time, Dario, and I want you to look for it, and I want all the listeners to look for it. I don't care if you pause it right now. There's a scene at a audio surveillance convention where in the background of a scene, behind Harry, someone walks behind him carrying a saxophone. I've never noticed it. I've watched the movie
right.
40 times, I think. And having it on the big screen splayed out there, watching it in such a like a nebulous, curious way, because I was just so appreciative to be in a dark room with this movie on a big screen, because it's just such a mesmerizing, you know, sensory experience. And I caught this thing, and I'm just like, what I now love about that final scene is he's torn the whole apartment down, but he will not tear apart his saxophone, and the saxophone may still be the tool that he's being listened to. So, you know, I was even thinking about it the other day. I was like, I'm going to delete Facebook. I'm going to delete Instagram. I'm just staying on Twitter because my little comfortable place on Twitter is fine. And then you just brought up the Google Homes or Alexis, and I'm like, God damn it. I'm going to tear the whole house apart, and that's still going to be sitting there recording everything I say.
Yeah, I mean, and it is that switch, isn't it, to from analog to digital. And, you know, the conversation is just so good with the whole analog technology. And I think it relates back to this scene and the whole of the film in terms of the use of the use of the phone in terms of setting up that unseen, that disembodied voice. I mean, I've just done an episode of The Cinematologist on the voice in cinema and how it's used. And this is this concept of acousmetre, which literally means the disembodied voice.
Yes.
And if you look at so many films that use an off-screen voice or a voice that's yet to be bodied,
yes,
it's often used for very specific purposes around power and around uncertainty, because it is the other. Where does that voice belong to? Where do you place it? And it makes your imagination click over about what that voice represents, because you can't attach it to a body.
Yeah, and what's so great is they play that incredible technique, acousmetre, as you said, I hope I pronounce it right. They play that incredible technique so beautifully in All the President's Men, and they want you to feel like it's passé. They want you to feel like the disembodied voices on the other end of the phone are, you know, inconsequential. Oh, it's just normal people.
Yeah.
But it's this moment that when it flips, you're like, oh no, it is that menacing thing. And then every other phone call that we see in the film has a different mood. It's like once one thing happens in this film, the mood shifts, the conversation changes, the intensity of the dialogue changes. And it's just like once that big bit of information, then it's like, okay. And it's similar to that. They're walking around, they're, you know, walking uncomfortably through a steamy summer in Washington, pounding pavement, knocking on doors. It's hot, like something I didn't know. Maybe you know, but I wasn't familiar. It's like Washington gets quite steamy in the summer. It's hot. So they're walking around in their short sleeves because it's so damn hot. But there's that moment where they go back to that woman's house a second time and she goes, please go away. They can see you. And as soon as they do that, it changes the fact that they've gone to see this, you know, 50, 100 people in this creep list. And so, it's just that's such a fascinating thing. Pakula loves that. He loves that technique, though. He loves a disembodied voice on a phone. He loves it.
Yeah. No, for sure. And also, I mean, you've got to credit Robert Redford for just some brilliant phone under the shoulder acting there. I mean, he just does that conversation, like with the phone. That's an old school landline thing, because nobody's got landlines anymore. No, you can't put a mobile phone under your shoulder. It's just like a little interaction between technology and the body that just doesn't occur. And he does it so beautifully. You know, it's amazing.
And it used to make you tired. Like if you were ever a person, if you were talking to a friend from overseas or whatever, like you know, long distance, or, you know, a girlfriend in high school, you used to get tired. You're like, oh, I'm tired. I don't want to hold my neck like this. All right, I got to go. My head's hurting. All right, see ya. Like it was that thing you could get off the phone. Whereas now, like the luxury of, you know, nice headphones and a good speaker on your headphones, you can just talk for hours. You're just walking around, go for an hour long walk, have a good old chat. It's very funny. It's very funny.
Yeah, it's interesting as well. I was just on the American politics. Just again, folk, a little aside, but you know, I was reading reports that before the Super Tuesday elections occurred, there was phone calls made from Obama to all the other candidates, telling them to drop out and support Joe Biden. because they were so, you know what I mean? It's like that sense of what's going on. And you can imagine those phone calls as little pieces of history. If you could hear those, that's all the President's Men all over.
I would love to hear those. I mean, that's, you know, it's actually funny. You know, you speak of, I don't know whether you've got the finger on the pulse or something, but like we're outsiders in Australia. So and in England, so you the American political machine is so, I think, almost perversely covered from our countries in a way, because it's so alien. Because, you know, I don't know the machinations there, and Dario can clear it up, but like in Australia, when you run an election, you get a 2-week period like to fund that campaign. There are no public donations. You can have volunteers that help you, but there, you know, the government is allowed, and both governments have budgets to do their ads. They do ads, you know, television ads, you know, social media ads, etc. But it is a very, like, very comparatively small and punchy, streamlined campaign. And there's occasionally a couple of tiers where you'll do like state government rather. And in the state government election, you vote for your local representatives. That's how you ladder up. You vote for your local rep, and they are part of one of our major political parties, and it ladders up to a political party that then has power in that state. And then similarly, we do the same thing for national. But it's so fast. The American cycle is they, all of the people on the one political party who really should form across a spectrum of like your political ideology, like some more extreme to the left if you're on the left, and then some towards the middle, and then similarly if it's on the right, it's there's sort of more centrist candidates, and there's crazy far righters. And they pit all these people together to fight for months. Like we watch externally with this like perverse, like, what the hell is going on? But the Daily, the New York Times, very, very well produced and insanely popular podcast. I listened to a show of theirs like maybe a week ago that was talking in depth about predictions of, you know, the Super Tuesday. The Super Tuesday was the turning point for Biden, and that he'd been hitting the ground hard to canvas support for the, in the black community, and working through there, and, you know, especially, you know, a conservative, you know, although left-leaning, but conservative black voters like churchgoers, etc., and getting all that and drumming up their support. And they're like, yeah, if it's successful, he'll basically put himself as the front runner. And then like a week later, they were right. I'm like, man, this is journalists who have got their fingers on the pulse. Like, they're not just looking at what all the central tracking is. They're understanding the country exists, you know, with a massive center of influential votes, and, you know, they're going to come to bear on this particular day. It's really crazy.
Yeah, I mean, they're essentially nonstop campaigning in America, aren't they? I mean, over here, I think it's 6 weeks, and there are incredibly stringent rules about financing of campaigns. I mean, I think we had somebody spent over £100,000 more than the budget, and it was on the, you know, it was on the front pages for a week. It's like corruption in politics. It's like, Jesus Christ, you want to go over to America? It's just the Wild West over there.
And speaking of this, and the great Slow Burn podcast with Leon Neyfuck, you know, they talk about like Nixon going, you need $1 million to pay off the Watergate burglars. I can get you $1 million, like $1,000,972 to pay people crazy, off is a lot of money. That's a lot. Oh God. I think, you know, you as a lecturer and someone who's looking for texts that are so rich that you can just consume them over and over again, I've just got this pause on the final frame as we're leading now into the 29th minute. And man, just every damn thing I love about the frame of this, the extras are so phenomenal. The offices are adorned with different styles of pictures and maps, the desk plates, the collapsing books and phone books and, you know, almanacs of American politics and, you know, the last budget. Man, this film is just so fastidiously created that every frame that I pause myself on, I'm like, man, this is a piece of, you know, for us to get slightly highfalutin, some detailed mise-en-scene that you can just really like chew on and, you know, ponder like, oh, what's that guy working on over there? What desk does he work for? Is he local? Yeah. Is he national? So much great stuff in this frame. So much great stuff that's happening in this scene.
Yeah, it's an interesting film because it's not overtly stylized in the same way as other conspiracy films are. I mean, if you could compare to the Parallax View, for example,
same director, chalk and cheese,
and very, very dark, shadowy, almost noirish, using that sense of, you know, there's people round corners at any given moment to give you that real sort of tension throughout, like somebody is being chased. Whereas here, there is that, he is going for a sense of realism. And when you're in the newspaper office, it's just bathed in this light, obviously. And it's almost as if he's saying, you know, this is where everything is transparent and where there's clarity. And there's only really the deep throat scenes where it's shadowy for obvious reasons. And because it's so obvious, it demarcates it from the rest of the film. But then you get, obviously, the aerial shots and the ones that start down by them, and especially when they're looking in the library and it moves up. And it's whether that is both simultaneously a kind of surveillance shot and it's also a needle in a haystack shot.
Yes. And so the needle in the haystack shot, it's both in my mind. The needle in the haystack shot that still gets me to this day is just watching, and you talk about a disembodied voice. It's actually a disembodied voice seen in this film, but you know who the voice belongs to because it's both Woodward and Bernstein that are talking in the voiceover. It's that city. They're saying names on this Crete list, and the camera starts pulling back to show you Washington, which is just this humming city. Things are thriving, people are driving, and it's just like these guys are up against not only the machine of politics, they're up against the machine of society, like people just getting the hell on with their lives. And I think that's a great yardstick for this movie. It's like people, you know, and it's these little conversations that you could totally ignore, but these guys have to continue to battle through, and they become like huge, significant battles and micro breakthroughs that ultimately lead to like this macro sort of tsunami-esque, you know, wave that delivers exactly what is going to come at the end of this.
Yeah, and when I was writing about this years ago, and the one book that really sort of stuck with me, an academic book, was called The Geopolitical Aesthetic. I don't know if you've ever heard of it. It's by a guy called Frederick Jameson, and it's absolutely, you know, a kind of very densely written, obtuse, difficult to understand academic book. But he sort of goes into absolute detail about all these conspiracy films as a sort of totality of conspiracy in the latter half of the 20th century. He's just basically sort of talks about it as this is the world that we exist in the fact that we can't, we see it there, but we can't understand its dimensions. And he used this term, cognitive mapping. And what cognitive mapping is, it's this, it's the way that we're, like when we go to the shops or the supermarket or we go to work, we don't think about where it is. We just go there because we've got a sense of where it is in the totality of our lives. So it works on a kind of spatial level, but it works on a psychological level. And what he argues about conspiracy films is that they give us a little bit of a cognitive map of what our position is in the totality of the world and all the global politics that is going on. It gives us a little entryway into that because it explains the stuff and takes us through the labyrinths and gives us the elements of the story that relate to certain people around the conspiracy. But at the end of the day, it never really maps out the entirety of the conspiracy.
I think that cognitive mapping, and sorry, can you repeat his name for me? What was his name?
Yeah, the guy's name's Frederick Jameson.
So Frederick Jameson, I think, stumbled on something that gamers exploit, which is that whole cognitive mapping exercises. There's something that's so infuriating and also tantalizing when you're playing a game. And what happens is you zoom out on your map, you go to your options button and you hit it, and there it is. You've done a tiny proportion of the map that you've opened up, and the rest of it is completely opaque. Like it's like a dark cloud sitting over it, and it's like it's that conspiratorial, I must know what is underneath. And then sometimes you cut big swathes through it and you get it and you realize that there are still nooks and crannies you haven't explored. And I think that's just like that cognitive mapping thing is like such a great encapsulation of what it is, because as you do it, like you said, it becomes a foundational premise. If someone can be gotten and these phones on the people on the phones are no longer just humans doing good, but potentially participants in a machine that is designed to be obtuse, then it's like, well, this is a foundational moment, you know?
Yeah. And sorry, go ahead.
My thing I was going to say is I have to just say, we might wrap up quickly shortly.
Sure.
And, but I'm going to demand that you come back on the show in the nicest possible sure. way, because I feel like I hijacked you and I potentially going down some serious, beautiful, intellectual rabbit holes of paranoia because of just the state of the world that we're in. So I'm going to I'm going to say you've got a permanent invite to come back, Dario, anytime.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
And guys, you simply must, you know, I think we asked for a little patch of some, a couple of bucks to chuck at us. There is an incredible newsletter and the Cinematologist podcast that you can download. There's free elements. There's a whole stack of you know, worth your money and time investments. And I just want to say you have to do that. I will link it all in the descriptions and on our page. But Dario, I just want to say it's a pleasure talking to you, man. And so I want to do this again. Next time I will let you pick your minute so you can find something really, really juicy.
Right.
I just want to say thank you so much for taking the time to chat to me. Before we go down more rabbit holes, I think we need a whole other podcast to talk about what is coming up next.
Sure, it'd been my pleasure to come back on again. I just want to say I really enjoy all of the productions that you've done, and look out, there's actually an academic piece on film podcasting that's coming out in the summer that I've written, and you're mentioned in that, so I'll send that along to you.
Wow, that is really nice, and I appreciate that. I can't wait to read it. Thank you so much. And look, there is a Cinematologist podcast simmering with myself on there.
Yeah, it's that actually should be already out. I don't know
by the time this comes out, depending on the past and the future, and whenever you listen to this podcast, finally there might be an episode with me and Dario and I went really long about not only the process of podcasting, but also just the examination technique that I think that anyone who's listening to this show might just be able to sort of chew on and sort of think about some of the intellectual stuff, the juices that are flowing as we're tackling these things segment by segment. But it's a pleasure to talk to you, my friend. Thank you so much for being a part of this show, and likely in the future. And may when you all listen to this, there still is a future. There still is podcasts about movies a minute at a time. But we'll be back and talk to you soon.
Take care. Stay safe.
You too, my friend. Thank you.
A huge thank you to my great guest, Dario Linares, there. If you want to follow Dario on Twitter, it is at Dario double L. So it's double L actually written out. D-O-U-B-L-E-L for Larry. Go to any of the great podcast apps that are used and search The Cinematologist for his excellent podcast. I'm so lucky to be on the 99th episode of The Cinematologist podcast, which is up right now for you to listen to. So if you have listened to this and you want to dive in, please go there right now. Absolutely brilliant. And all the back catalog of the great Cinematologist podcasts are there and around. So hugely grateful for Dario, for Neil, and it's an honor to be on their show and now to be featured in an article in the upcoming summer. Really exciting times. This has been another One Heat Minute production. Thank you so much for listening along. We have an amazing array of shows. One Heat Minute, obviously, The Last 12 Minutes of the Mohicans, Increment Vice, Josie and the Podcats, All the President's Minutes, which you're listening to today, and our daily podcast, Con 10 Gen, which is a tight 10 talking to a whole stack of folks in isolation, in quarantine, sort of accounting for, in this community, everything that's going down. Listen along to that daily. We're going to have great shows coming up for you, some unannounced stuff, which we are going to announce to tease for the future. But if you want to support us, we do have a Patreon, and you can find links to that on oneheatminute.com. If you want to go to our site, oneheatminute.com or incrementvice.com, you can find out more about the shows. And if you want to go to graffitiwithpunctuation.com, you can read about Contingent and our upcoming 6-part limited series, Josie and the Podcats. Until next time, thank you so much. Subscribe, rate, review, share. Thanks so much for listening.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.